Hello and welcome to the Trading Places episode of Slate Money Goes to the Movies. Yeah, we're going to the movies. We are doing a whole little mini season of watching movies with a business and finance theme. We are going to be doing this throughout the early weeks of 2021, but there is a Christmas movie on the list. It is called Trading Places. It is Christmas. And so as a little sneak preview, the very first episode of the season is going to be Trading Places. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Anna Szymanski of Breaking Views.
Hello.
I'm here with Yinka Adegoke of Quartz.
Hi.
Yinka, how old were you when you first saw this movie and what country were you living in?
Oh, that one of those questions I can say confidently, Nigeria. I was in my teens. Let's leave it there.
Young teens. We are going to be talking about Trading Places, the classic John Landis 1983 Eddie Murphy vehicle starring Dan Aykroyd, Denham Elliott, and Jamie Lee Curtis, and all manner of other folks, including Al Franken, weirdly enough. And we are going to be talking in a very jumpy, aroundy, discursive way about the movie, its acting, its themes, the money, whether it's realistic. We are not going to be running through the plot in any kind of useful way. So if you haven't seen the movie, go see the movie first and then listen to us. Or if you basically remember it, you can listen to this. But if you have never seen the movie, you will not understand a word that we're saying. It is not a great spoiler to admit that we all like this movie. It's a good movie, so it's worth seeing. It is worth renting. Go ahead and do that, and we will find you on the other side of Slate Money Goes to the Movies. So, Yinka, you specifically requested that we talk about Trading Places when we were chatting on the phone. And I was like, we're doing this season. You're like, I need to do Trading Places.
We have to do it, Felix.
So explain to
me. It is the best business movie we ever made. Everyone knows this. Everyone knows the best business movie about Wall Street specifically.
Is it the best Christmas movie of all time?
You know, some of us have taken it to be a Christmas movie. It's not. Rewatching it again all these years later, I'd kind of forgotten some of the unedited bits are probably not suitable for family viewing.
A few things.
I had completely forgotten.
Wait, had you forgotten, like, the boobs?
Completely forgotten. You know, like, teenage me obviously enjoyed this immensely, but grown up me, dad me is kind of like, well, not while the kids are here.
There's a bunch of nudity, there's a bunch of swearing, there's a bunch of like extremely inappropriate racism, and there's a lot of problematic stuff in this movie. As you would expect from the director of Animal House, this was, I think, the follow-up. Was this John Landis's follow-up to Animal House? This is an amazing run of movies, actually. John Landis did in his 20s and early 30s. Animal House, The Blues Brothers, American Werewolf in London, and Trading Places, all within the space of 5 years.
And then later Coming to America.
And then later Coming to America.
In between the Thriller video.
Yes.
And then he did the Thriller video, and then it was all over at that point. But it's an amazing run of movies. It reminds me a little bit, actually, of Oliver Stone, who sort of does Platoon and then he follows it up with Wall Street. Like, somehow, if you do something which has this big, broad, mass appeal, you can say, I want to make a movie about derivatives trading. And everyone goes, yeah, of course, let you do whatever you want.
Right. But derivatives trading in the 80s was exciting, like visually extraordinarily exciting in a way that not quite the same today.
Yes.
If derivatives trading was actually exciting, Anna, there would be more than one movie about derivatives trading.
No, but you talk to people who were like commodities traders in the 80s and they talk about those like scrums where you literally had people screaming at each other.
Let's get into it. So this is the first question which we have to ask. There's that classic scene at the end of the movie where the trader gets carried out of the pit, like basically semi-conscious to get screamed at by the Duke brothers. Are you saying that's not complete artistic license, that there's some kind of reality there?
I mean, I'm not sure if somebody got dragged out unconscious, but definitely that is, again, I did not experience that. I was one when this film was made. But when I've talked with people who did, this is what they always point to and say, yeah, this is actually one of the more accurate depictions.
Yeah, everything I've read about it says it's pretty much the same. All the old guys are all kind of like, yeah, yep, this is what it was like. It was raw, it was real, there's blood, sweat, tears, the whole kind of drama. And the kind of thing that, I guess, makes people want to come to New York and work on Wall Street or Chicago commodities or whatever.
That's one of the reasons why I also really like this movie, because there's that scene where they're walking into what I actually think was the World Trade Center.
Yes.
And the Dan Aykroyd character is describing what they're going to be walking into.
Favorite scene.
And he describes it as like the most exciting thing you can possibly imagine. And what you see, it's both of these things. It's this like almost animalistic capitalism at its most raw. But at the same time, it is really exciting. And I feel like that kind of gets at that contradiction in a way that a lot of other films, I think, are a little bit more lazy.
Think big. Think positive. Never show any sign of weakness. Always go for the throat. Buy low, sell high. Fear, that's the other guy's problem. Nothing you have ever experienced can prepare you for the unbridled carnage you're about to witness. Right. Super Bowl, a World Series, they don't know what pressure is. In this building, it's either kill or be killed. Right. You make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners.
No prisoners.
1 minute, you're up 500,000 in soybeans, and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
Yeah, but we gotta kill him, motherfucker! We gotta kill him!
That scene is my favorite. That piece of dialogue, I should say, is just like my favorite. It's just the way he lays it all out. And for me, like, I watched this, I can't remember how old I was, 30 years ago, whatever. And I hadn't, I visited America once, but I hadn't lived here. Didn't really fully get it. And I was like, oh, whoa, if he loses money, his kids don't go to college? This was just such a weird concept
right.
to me. Because everywhere I lived, college was free. Essentially, it was a question whether you could get in. But in America, you have to pay to go to college and you have to work really hard and make a lot of money. And it's kind of like, it really explained America to me then. And it kind of still does. It's kind of still relevant. You could make all this money in America, but you could also lose it. And there is no safety net.
The only difference is that instead of the World Trade Center, we now have Robin Hood.
You definitely lose it all in Robin Hood, right?
But no, but I do think this film also, it gets at this very complicated relationship that America does have with wealth. And I think it's notable that the film is set mostly in Philadelphia, so they kind of have all these scenes of like Americana, Ben Franklin, this idea of the scrappy upstart who, you know.
Especially the intro, the first scenes.
Yep.
Beautifully done.
The credit sequence. Let's talk about the credit sequence, because it's actually very different in a sort of tonally from the rest of the movie. The movie, it's got a huge amount of forward momentum. It's not a short movie, but it swings past very quickly. There's broad comedy. There's a whole bunch of it's very tightly written. But the opening credits is basically just this incredibly loving portrait of working class Philadelphia over the overture to The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. And you're like, huh, what are we doing here with Mozart and working class Philadelphia when neither of those things are obviously related to, well, derivatives trading for starters?
But they show you the extremes, right? Because it's not just the working class Philadelphia they show you. They also show you the wealthy parts of Philadelphia right next door to poor kids playing basketball without a proper hoop. But it's just beautifully done. And I love the way it sort of goes all the way right into our first scene with Dan Aykroyd waking up for breakfast.
With his valet, his butler, his gentleman's gentleman, yes. Whatever you want to call it.
And he's making orange juice.
Yes. You make a really good point, Felix. It's almost out of sync with the rest of the movie, with the pace of the rest of the movie. And yet, it lays it all out for us. Especially for those of us who don't know Philadelphia that well or don't fully understand what we're about to get into.
I have to say, I don't fully understand why it's set in Philadelphia. I would have thought, if this is a derivatives trading thing, like
Chicago.
Set it in Chicago,
right.
Possibly set it in New York. What is it doing in Philadelphia? Do we understand that?
I really think it's so they could have those scenes of Americana, because I think this is a film about American myths.
There's no Americana in Chicago?
There is, but it's not Philadelphia. You're not going to have Ben Franklin. You have a men's club that says liberty and justice for all on it.
Right.
You know, I think that's why they did it.
It is a lot more conservative. You do have the extremes of, I guess, put it this way, it's always ludicrous to think that a young executive at a trading house is going to have a butler with a chauffeur-driven limousine and get around and be all sort of like hoity-toity like that. But if it would happen anywhere, I suppose it would happen in Philadelphia.
That's actually true. You know, but I think like this is, I mean, obviously the film really is about this moment in the 80s where you are seeing the rise of finance, the rise of this like extreme wealth at the same time that you're seeing very, very visible poverty as you're seeing more and more homeless people on the street at that time. And that's clearly what this film is about. I think it's notable that, you know, it's basically a Prince of the Pauper update. Prince and Pauper was written during the Gilded Age. I think that's clearly what it's getting at.
So we have this introduction of the princes and the paupers. We have Denham Elliott polishing up, ironing the newspaper, whatever it is he's doing, while the kids are playing basketball with no hoop. And we meet our protagonist, Lewis, Dan Aykroyd, and he's kind of a dick. And this is one of the things which really fascinates me about this movie. You have two clear bad guys. You have three clear people with hearts of gold, one of whom is a hooker. And then in the middle, you have the actual main character who winds up on the side of good rather than evil, I guess, but kind of despite himself, he's just not a good person. And that one fascinates me.
Right, but I think that in storytelling in general, you want to show an arc. You want to show a change.
Do you think he changes?
I mean, he becomes less actively mean. But no, but it is interesting because he is the center of the film, even though clearly the real center of the film is Eddie Murphy.
Yeah. I mean, he has all the best lines, Dan Aykroyd. He has all the best lines, and Eddie Murphy has the best quips. He has the best comebacks. Eddie Murphy in the 80s, he was a god, right? He stole scenes just by being there. And really, because, you know, you hadn't had that kind of combination of bad boy slash comedian slash good-looking, well-dressed, well-put-together, all that, all together in this one package. And then just hit after hit after hit, right? 48 Hours, Trading Places, Beverly Hills. But in this movie, here he is alongside Dan Aykroyd, who's already an established star. Sure, he was on a bit of a wane, but I mean, he doesn't outshine him, but he completely, you know, holds his own, and they make this into something really special.
Yeah, and his character, it's interesting because he similarly goes through a change, but the change is almost like the real him that would have existed.
Exactly. It's almost like that experiment works, right?
Exactly. Right, right.
Well, the experiment clearly works, right? It's clear who wins the bet. It's clearly a question of nature rather than nurture. Eddie Murphy takes, what, about like less than a day to start worrying about his carpets?
His furniture.
His Persian rug.
His Persian rug.
From Persia.
From Persia.
And Dan Aykroyd takes like less than 2 days to start like pulling guns on people and trying to shoot himself. Which again, like, you have to treat all of this with a certain amount of poetic license.
No, it's a myth, you know.
It is a Christmas movie, after all. It's not meant to be full to the brim with verisimilitude. But you do have that very quick and very simple, oh yeah, it's obvious, the bet has been decisively won on this side rather than that side. And that happens very quickly. I feel like the bet is a bit of a MacGuffin, really, that the movie isn't really about the bet, but I might be wrong. I want to know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bet is important because obviously the entire film, you're just like, you know, these people are horrible for playing with these people's lives. But then when it turns out it's for $1, it just speaks to this idea of what I do think the film is trying to get at, that you have this new wealthy class that doesn't value other people's lives. I clearly think that's what, I mean, the Dukes, if you pay attention, I noticed this because I was watching it very closely because I knew we were going to talk about it. They have a photo of Ronald Reagan on their desk and a photo of Richard Nixon on their desk.
Were you like pausing the movie?
No, I made so many notes.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
So the Dukes, we should mention this, the Dukes are clearly based on the Hunt brothers who cornered the market in silver. And there's this line towards the end of the movie when they start buying up all of the frozen concentrated orange juice where someone's like, they're trying to corner the market.
Hey, the Dukes are trying to corner the market.
They know something. I can feel it.
Let's get in on it.
200, take them.
200!
Move it!
Not yet. Almost.
220, take them! 209!
Yeah, got him.
139! 140!
Hey, to me, Minneapolis.
Now.
Yeah. South Dakota, April of 142!
Anna is the finance pro here. What does it mean to corner the market? And is that bit realistic?
I mean, I think that's obviously somewhat extreme. It's not that you wouldn't necessarily have someone who's essentially trying to buy up a significant portion of futures contracts in a particular commodity, but the level of buying you're seeing at the time, and especially the difference in price that occurs, has almost never happened. I don't think it's ever happened. They sell at 142 and they buy at 29 cents. Like, you don't see that type of movement. But
although, can I say, this is actually my favorite thing about the whole movie, is the slogan. We all know the slogan about buy low, sell high. But for reasons which I just love, and I don't know whose idea this was, the great grand finale, they sell high and buy low.
Yep.
They sell before they buy.
Short selling, yep.
They go short and then they cover their short. And then that's just like this little piece of financial cleverness. It's mm-hmm. slipped in there and you're like, ooh, that's clever. I love that. I love that little tweak. Most normal screenwriters would have been like, well, buy low and sell high. No, they decided to sell short, cover the short, which again, like in terms of being realistic, number one, there's no way that someone can get onto the floor of the futures exchange with like a $40,000 check from a hooker with a heart of gold.
I was going to ask about that.
$42,000 in T-bills.
And suddenly get like a $300 million margin account on the basis of that. But even if you kind of allow them that, as you say, like there's a lot of over-dramatization there, but I do think there is something real underneath it, which is this thing that happened in the 70s and I think even the 80s, that people would try, mostly fail, but definitely try to corner the market. Yeah. And cornering the market was a thing that happened back then, and it hasn't happened that I can recall in decades. I think markets all just do big and liquid right now.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that's something that you could possibly do with just how technology has changed, how trading has changed. Yeah, I don't think that's possible.
But back in the day, it was a thing. And basically what it means is buying up so much of whatever the commodity is, whether it's silver or orange juice or whatever, that you control the price. And the controlling of the price and the manipulating of the markets, like that was all just part of the game, right? This is the other thing that really struck me rewatching this movie, is that our heroes, the good guys, are the ones who are manipulating the markets, who are feeding false information to the Hunt brothers, who are insider trading on material non-public information. And those are the good guys who are doing all of that.
Well, no, but this is the actually also fascinating thing. What they did and what the Duke brothers did was not actually illegal at the time. It was only in 2010 that it became illegal to trade based on insider information from the government. And it was actually called the Eddie Murphy rule.
It literally took the financial crisis to make this illegal. This kind of stuff would have been illegal on the stock market for ever since 1930, whenever the hell, and the creation of the SEC. But the SEC doesn't govern derivatives markets. The CFTC does, which is part of the Agriculture Committee in the Senate. It's completely different. And it's the Wild West.
But isn't the principle the same though, Felix?
Exactly. The principle is exactly the same.
Huh. Agreed. But also going back to what I think you were trying to maybe get at too, the idea that our heroes are manipulating the market. And again, I think this speaks to this like weird relationship that America has with wealth and especially the quick accumulation of wealth. That on the one hand, it's often the way that films end, is that somebody becomes extraordinarily wealthy. But then at the same time, wealthy characters in films are kind of suspect. And there's always this idea, too, that if someone's extraordinarily wealthy, usually it's because they did something wrong, wasn't through honest means. And to a certain extent, it's the same thing here.
Yeah, but they got one over the really bad guys.
Well, exactly. I mean, yeah, of course. You're all very happy when they end up on the island.
You can even hear it in their whole entire hubris towards the end of the movie. We've been on the exchange since he was set up.
And right,
This is ours. We own this exchange and all that stuff. And yeah. That's like, yeah, all right, serves them right.
No, exactly. And because I think it's also like, America's also this weird relationship with hereditary wealth. And I think that's kind of what the Dukes clearly are supposed to represent.
And that's what makes them suspicious. Although it's also what presumptively makes Lewis suspicious, right?
The third.
Right.
Lewis Winthrop, the third.
They're always the third.
Yeah.
Who talks like Katharine Hepburn for some unknown reason.
And he has to kind of get thrown out onto the street and hit rock bottom in basically what, in order to overcome the blinkers of his privilege and wealth, this highly privileged guy who went to Harvard and sailed into this top job, but apparently has no like family or support group whatsoever.
No, exactly. And his job mainly seems to be looking at payroll. Like, that seems to be his primary job.
I'm guessing the market, just guessing.
And then saying pork bellies.
Pork bellies. No, but this is the other thing which I wanted to ask you, Anna, is like the thing that he does at the beginning of the movie, which is then echoed by the thing that Eddie Murphy does a few scenes later, is bottom tick the market. You know, he's like, wait another 5 minutes and you can buy it for $1 less, and then you buy it there and then you make more money. The Duke brothers are very, very happy about that. So you just made us another $1 million. Is that realistic? Is that what trading was at the time? It's just like trying to work out exactly. It's basically market timing.
I mean, definitely there was a lot more market timing just for the nature of how trading worked. I mean, obviously everyone can't be doing that exactly the same. You know, it can't work for everyone at the same time. But I do think, I mean, obviously this is a simplistic representation of how that would work. But I think in general, there was way more than now, this sense of, especially I would say probably in some of those markets, this idea that you really could actually time certain things.
And certain people like Stevie Cohen is famous for being able to trade the tape.
Right.
You know, you see how the numbers are moving and you just have this feel for like when to buy and when to sell. And it's this kind of mystical thing.
Yeah. And you even have back in the day, the like technical analysis, we were like the dead man's cross and the head and shoulders of some stupid chart. And then
the dying hanging man formation.
Exactly. And it's like, oh, this is clearly going to go down because it's, you know. So, I mean, I think a lot of that kind of, you know, slightly ridiculous, though also slightly fun stuff has all really, to a certain extent, gone away.
It's been taken over by the algorithm, so.
Exactly, exactly. As I said, like, if they tried to make this film now, it would just be, like, people, like, looking at their Bloomberg.
So the modern day equivalent that sprung to mind when I was watching this of the Duke brothers going bankrupt and losing their company was John Corzine going bankrupt with MF Global. You remember after he was governor of New Jersey, he set up his own boutique investment bank and put on this can't lose trade involving something to do with like European sovereign bonds or something. I can't even remember what it was. And it blew up spectacularly and he lost everything, which just kind of goes to show that it's not as completely ludicrous as it maybe seems to someone who doesn't understand the market.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, obviously it is an exaggeration, but at the same time, you certainly did have instances where people lost their seat on the exchange because they couldn't meet their margin call like that. That was a very real thing.
Although they never really get into the nitty gritty, Anna, do they, of like the central clearing counterparty risk and what happens if Duke brothers can't make their margin call.
That wasn't nearly as exciting as just watching men scream at each other.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So, Yinka, let's move on a little bit and talk about race. Mm-hmm. When you first saw this as a non-American black person, like what on earth did you think?
This is the thing. It's just like Eddie Murphy's so cool. You don't really get past that, right? You just But, you know, so watching it again, seriously, it's like, huh, I don't remember all this. This is all this stuff was problematic because you see, they never actually, do you notice they never actually refer to Eddie Murphy as black? He's always called the Negro. It's just kind of like, oh, okay, but it was 1983. Surely we had started to use the word black. So the idea is supposed to get across is these guys are so out of the normal world. These people are so ridiculous and so over the top that this is the way they speak. Maybe, yeah, I guess we could believe that. And, you know, and there's an actual scene where Don Ameche's character uses the N-word. Maybe he would have, actually. But it's just like, it's not in the spirit of the movie itself. If you weren't like doing a hard Wall Street, people getting killed, that kind of thing. Okay. But this just felt like, yeah, unnecessary when you look at it now. At the time, this is the way America is, and it's a strange place, and this is the way they talk, and that kind of thing. You look at it very differently. And especially looking at it kind of with that same understanding of race in America itself, the whole place is strange.
Do you think that this is a movie about race? Is race like the primary subject? Is that what the movie is about or not?
No, I don't think it is, but Eddie Murphy brings it, right? Eddie Murphy himself brings it. You can tell and I think Philadelphia is like Boston, is like these cities where that class line is very strongly racial as well. I mean, this is pretty much many cities in America, but the class line is very, very clear that, you know, black working class people are a key part of the city. So you really get this sense that, okay, if we're going to show working class people, which we need to show because we want to show the other side of the track, we're going to show more black people. And then Eddie Murphy himself, who is he going to hang with? Who are the people who are going to be his friends? And who can he bring that kind of thing that Eddie Murphy brings with him? So you get like the party scene at the house.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the party scene at the house, yeah.
With the great Sylvester track playing.
And the highly realistic way in which all of the party guests just decided to get their tits out.
Dude, I don't know how much money you've had in your life, but when you have a certain level of money, this kind of thing probably does happen. I don't know.
I don't know, though. As we were discussing earlier, I feel like there are so many times in this movie where women take off their top for no apparent reason.
Yes, exactly. That was also a thing of the 80s.
I mean, it was probably written into the contract somewhere. Like, you know, you can make follow-up to Animal House, but there has to be, like, this many seconds of boobage. Otherwise, like, no one's going to watch a movie about derivatives trading. And that still goes on. I feel like, wasn't it Halle Berry who got paid an extra $1 million or something to get her boobs out in Swordfish? This is a little pop culture nugget that I have buried in the back of my head somewhere. Like,
I guess one of the other things that we haven't totally talked about, but just in terms of race, is that there also is the scene with blackface.
Yes, I'll get to that.
We really can't avoid mentioning the highly unfortunate blackface scene, which all you can say is, what were they thinking?
It's so unnecessary. It's like one of those things, before you get to offensive, it's like, but why? He could have been anyone. And it's almost like, nah, there's no need for this.
So they're in a train car. Everyone's walking in some kind of ludicrous getup. Apparently the bit about the Swede wearing lederhosen was totally ad-libbed because Jamie Lee Curtis had no idea how to do an Austrian accent. She could only do a Swedish accent.
Come in, my child. Join the party. Let me see now. You would be from Austria, am I right?
No, I am Inga from Sweden.
Sweden? But you're wearing lederhosen.
Yeah, for sure, from Sweden. Please to help me with my rucksack.
Oh, yeah, sure, why not?
But they all come in, and then the last of the huckster crew to come in is Dan Aykroyd, and what the hell is his disguise?
Yeah, he's so many levels of offense here. So he's clearly got shoe polish on his face. He's totally painted black, and he has some sort of supposedly Rastafarian wig, and he does this cold Jamaican accent. It's just the whole thing. It's one big why. It's a distraction from the silly humor of Eddie Murphy pretending he's from Cameroon, wearing some clothes are not from Cameroon, and Jamie Lee Curtis wearing with a Swedish accent. I mean, only Daniel Elliott pulls it off
with the Irish priest, which of course he can.
Yes, it's all silly, but Dan Aykroyd's thing is not silly, it's unnecessary and doesn't make the movie any better or cleverer or funnier.
And to your point right at the beginning, it does kind of make the entire movie unwatchable as a family Christmas movie. If you know, if all of the swearing and the nudity didn't do it, like that scene alone would do it.
It was the 80s, son.
But even if it's not a family movie, and it is clearly not a family movie for all of the reasons we've understood, is it a Christmas movie? Is there like a Christmas theme here? Or is it, what's with all of the Christmas stuff if it's not a Christmas movie?
You know, in a way, I could say it's almost like an Easter movie, because the Dan Aykroyd character, it's kind of like he dies and rises again. Like, I definitely think there's some potential Christ stuff going here.
Dan Aykroyd is a Christ figure.
Exactly.
I did not expect Slate Bunny to get this religious. No, it starts at Thanksgiving, doesn't it? It starts around Thanksgiving. It's, you could call it a holiday movie. Mm-hmm. Are we still saying that, or we're back in Trump times. I can't remember.
I think you're right. It definitely has a festive feel to it. Mm-hmm. There's obviously the big New Year's Eve scene on the train, which apparently there were like raging New Year's Eve parties on Amtrak in the 80s. Who knew?
I missed the 80s.
With Joe Biden.
And Al Franken.
And Al Franken. That's right.
Talk about two senators.
with the bizarre gorilla subplot.
Sis, that also seemed unnecessary, but you know.
I agree. Yeah, that also got some unnecessary rape jokes that we also got in this.
What, you don't think gorilla rape is like something which we should put into a family Christmas movie?
I actually very much remember watching this film. I'm pretty sure when I watched it, I was probably like 6 or 7 around Christmas time with my family.
Yes,
so,
as did I.
80s were a weird time, yeah.
I was wondering why I couldn't remember so many slightly more grown-up stuff, and I thought perhaps it's because I've always just stopped to watch it on television. And right. maybe a lot of stuff is being taken out. So I kind of, over the years, forgotten.
This is actually a really good point, that the reason it still has cultural currency, the reason it still resonates, the reason if you mention Trading Places on Twitter, everyone will know exactly what you're talking about, is because it's shown on the telly, and the version you see on the telly is maybe not the version we just rewatched.
Definitely you are not going to see the scenes, the party scenes.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because I watched it again, I was like, what? How did I forget this? This is an important part of my development as a child.
And that's
super,
that's very American in its own way, right? The kind of bowdlerization / mainstreaming of anything offensive into something which is just mainstream and fun.
Well, and especially at that time when people watched movies on like regular channels. Right, you know, it was before the rise of like, you know, cable.
Well, you also almost wonder why. It's to your point about the boob scenes and all this stuff and the bad language, almost like why? I guess it was movies were just made in a different way then.
I don't have a problem with the language. One of the running jokes in the movie is Eddie Murphy catching himself swearing. And
yes,
I love
yes,
that.
Yes,
and I would not give that up for anything, because that's a glorious like thing.
That worked.
But there definitely is, I mean, this is a period of time where you are getting these like, Animal House is like the prototypical, but like these like frat boy kind of movies and this frat boy sensibility. And you see this in a lot of films at this time. And I think this was just what these guys thought was funny. And they put in everything they thought was funny.
Makes perfect sense.
And as I mentioned, John Landis was barely 30 when he made this movie. Now, this is not made by some grizzled old film director. Like, I actually have a harder time justifying the quantity of boobage in like The Wolf of Wall Street made when Marty Scorsese is like 79. That one, you're like, come on, you don't need it. It starts becoming gratuitous. This one, it's like it was much more of a creature of its time, made by a kid.
If you give a 30-year-old man a lot of money, you're going to get boobs, probably.
And a lot of drugs. I mean, you know that like John Landis and Jim Belushi were not just sitting drinking club soda.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's where the gorilla subplot came from.
I didn't realize he was that young. That's crazy.
So final verdict on Trading Places. Does it hold up? How do we rate it as a finance movie? And finally, the big question which I want to ask is, how does it rate as part of the mythos of finance? This idea of the young trader who manages to finally turn on the evil, grizzled, money-grubbing old-timer. Is it successful?
Let me go with a general, how does it hold up? I have to admit, it was less of a movie than I remembered, right, when I really sat down and watched it all the way through. But still a ton of fun. I still laughed. Yes, I paused at some of the scenes that I thought were, you know, not for this time. And probably some of them were not for that time either, to be honest.
Anytime.
It's funny. Sometimes you watch these things as to where you are now. And because I am a parent of young children now, my first thought is, I'd love to watch this with, oh, no, no, no. It's also not a thing where I feel I'm going to call my friends around and say, we must watch Trading Places, because it's not that much of a great movie either in that sense. I still know all the key lines. I still think Eddie Murphy was as cool as anyone on the planet then. Everyone in finance is closest to a great finance movie, but I'll let Anna.
Anna, is this as close as it gets to a great finance movie?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I really do think, outside of obviously the very, very problematic things we discussed, I really do think this is one of like the best finance movies. And I think partly because it's almost like a fairy tale. You know, everything is exaggerated, but I actually feel like it gets at something in that exaggeration. And as I said, I think it gets at both the attraction and why it repels people at the same time in a way that I don't know if I can really think of any other film that does that well.
Excellent. I think that's a perfect sum up. Thank you very much, Anna. Thank you very much, Yinka, for joining us here. And we will come back in the new year with more movies about business and finance. But this was a sneak Christmas preview, you might say, with a fabulous Christmas movie.